you better support your patient's brain health. Did you miss the live FX Medicine Perspectives Forum? Catch up anytime, as the panel discussion is now available to view on demand. Join clinical psychologist Dr. Adrienne Lopresti and FX Medicine ambassadors myself, Emma Sutherland, Lisa Costa-Beer, and Mick Alexander as we unpack the latest clinical insights into brain health. From hormonal shifts and movement medicine to nutrient depletions and the gut-brain axis, this panel delivers practical strategies you can apply in clinic right away. You'll take away real-world clinical applications, clinical insights from an expert-led discussion, and take home actionable insights for practitioners. Watch the recording by logging on to bioceuticals.com.au/education and walk away with practical insights you can use in clinic right away.
Hi, and welcome to FX Medicine by Bioceuticals, where we bring you the latest in evidence-based, integrative, functional, and complementary medicine. FX Medicine by Bioceuticals acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia, where we live and work, and the connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respect to the elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today. Dr. Melanie Smith is a clinical health psychologist based in the UK, where she has been working in the physical health field. Dr. Smith has expertise in the psychological treatment of menopause and was the lead therapist in studies evaluating the effectiveness of cognitive behaviour therapy for menopause and the treatment of hot flushes and night sweats following breast cancer treatment. Dr. Smith is also the co-author of three books on the use of CBT for menopause and the management of hot flushes and night sweats. Welcome to FX Medicine by Bioceuticals, Melanie. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's really nice to be here.
No, it's certainly great to have you here talking about menopause and everything about menopause, some of the symptoms that many women will experience when they go through menopause, and specifically talking about some of the psychological treatments for menopause. That's what I was really hoping to focus on today. So I hope we can give it a brief overview today, that's for sure.
Yeah, me too. I hope so. That would be good.
So firstly, for our listeners, can you briefly describe some of the physical and mental symptoms that occur during the transition into menopause?
Yeah, so really common symptoms are hot flushes and night sweats. A lot of women report sleep disturbances and also mood changes, so irritability, low mood, anxiety. And commonly people, women report kind of joint pains as well as fatigue and urinary symptoms, changes in sex drive. So those are kind of a range of symptoms that can be experienced. But I think the key thing really is that it's not a universal experience. So different women will experience different symptoms. I think commonly most, I think about up to 80% of women can experience hot flushes and night sweats, and then there's variation with the other symptoms as well.
Okay. Now, do women who experience hot flushes during the day, are they also likely to experience the sweat night sweats too?
Yeah, so the hot flush and night sweat symptoms, they tend to go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. So it's because of changes in the body's thermoregulation processes that's influenced by fluctuations in hormones, particularly estrogen. So yes, they often tend to go hand in hand.
And you mentioned obviously some changes in mood, irritability, anxiety, mood-related problems. How common are they?
Well, there's real variability really depending on which studies you looked at. So recent meta-analyses suggested about a third of women, just over a third of women in relation to depression. But what they kind of recognised or noted was that how depression was measured was kind of varied between studies. So I think we can confidently say for a proportion of women that depression is, or mood changes can be an issue, but whether that's kind of a full diagnosis of clinical depression or whether, you know, on a self-report questionnaire, they've ticked, there's an uptick really in the presence of depressive symptoms. You know, it really depends on how it's measured. I think what we do know from data is that the risk of experiencing depression for the first time is not kind of significantly increased over menopause transition, but actually there are a number of risk factors that might kind of contribute to women developing depression or mood symptoms through the transition that we're aware of.
And is it, I mean, I suppose if I don't know what the research says with regards to this or even if it's been investigated, but if a person doesn't experience menopausal symptoms, such as your hot flushes and your urinary symptoms and things like that, are they less likely to experience depression and anxiety? Do you know what the research says about that?
Well, we know that, particularly with depression, that menopausal symptoms can be a contributing risk factor in terms of mood. So if women are struggling with severe hot flushes and particularly night sweats that disturb sleep, if they have a long menopause transition, so they have symptoms such as hot flushes and night sweats are present for a long period of time, they're at a higher risk of developing kind of mood difficulties. So, certainly menopausal, those kind of physical symptoms of menopause are definitely going to be a risk factor due to the kind of impact that they have. With regards to anxiety, similar to the kind of depression studies, we know that women don't universally all become more anxious during the menopause transition, but we know that certainly, again, there is an uptick in the proportion, and again, there are the same kind of issues with measurement as there are with the kind of depression studies. So I think menopausal symptoms can be stressful, and we know that stress exacerbates symptoms, and therefore stress and anxiety can sometimes go hand in hand, although women do experience anxiety, or some women do experience anxiety generally as part of the transition.
I suppose there's really a bi-directional relationship, isn't there, that the menopausal symptoms can contribute to depression and anxiety, and then having depression and anxiety can also exacerbate some of the menopausal symptoms.
I think it's more that kind of with the presence of depression and anxiety undermines our ability to cope. So what we know from the research is that if we're struggling with depression and anxiety, either prior to menopause or that's kind of onset during menopause, then that undermines our ability to cope with kind of symptoms such as hot flushes and fatigue. So it's not so much a cause as it contributes to menopause symptoms being more challenging. But yes, certainly menopause symptoms themselves are distressing and can have an impact on mood, anxiety and general stress levels. That's kind of one of the things that we're aware of.
Now, the other symptom you mentioned was sleep disturbances. So can you tell us a little bit about sleep and what happens, what's the prevalence of sleep problems during menopause?
Yeah, so there's, again, a range of prevalence data. So 40 to 60% of women in self-report studies report difficulties with sleep. And it's a combination, really, of being able to fall asleep. But we know that kind of staying asleep is one of the most common issues. So, and again, there are kind of risk factors that can contribute to that. So we know that, of course, night sweats are a common issue that kind of impacts sleep quality and are more likely to lead to waking at night. But we also know, again, that women who have life stress or other health issues also are more likely to experience insomnia, be that falling asleep or waking after sleep onset.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose if you had a previous history of sleep disturbances or insomnia, then certainly some of those menopausal symptoms is only going to exacerbate the problems for people, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know particularly with kind of chronic insomnia, there are the, if we think about kind of some of the factors that can lead to chronic insomnia are kind of when women or when anybody struggles to go to sleep, we often experience anxiety and rumination. And so therefore you might kind of imagine that if sleep quality is reduced or night sweats, for example, are waking women up, then that's, again, a really stressful time, isn't it? Often women are really, you know, we've got busy lives. So it's often then where insomnia or difficulties with insomnia then almost become established, because it's often the kind of anxiety and the rumination that then leads to kind of hyperarousal that then kind of establishes insomnia as an issue. Yeah.
I mean, the other one, obviously the one that's, you know, the symptom that's most commonly talked about is your vasomotor symptoms, your hot flushes and your night sweats. And so you mentioned there are, what, up to 90% of women, is that right, that experience those symptoms?
So it's, again, there's variation depending on the study that you're looking at, but 60 to 80% of women in Western cultures experience hot flushes and or night sweats. What we know is that about a quarter experience kind of severe hot flushes that then lead them to go on and perhaps seek help in terms of, you know, HRT, which is a really efficacious treatment for those. But there is variation across cultures, which I think is really interesting.
What do you think counts for the differences across cultures?
If I'm honest, I'm not entirely sure. I think it's probably quite complex. We've got suggestions about, so for example, in Asian countries, women are more likely to less likely to report hot flushes and night sweats, and are more likely to report symptoms such as joint pains, headaches and chills. In Japanese women in particular, in Taiwanese women, they talked about the findings are that they report more prevalently headaches and tiredness. So we can kind of speculate about, you know, there's been some suggestions that it might be related to diet in those countries. But there's also, you know, if we look globally, there's kind of hypotheses about psychosocial factors that might contribute to differing symptoms. So is it that in some kind of countries there's a more conservative approach to health issues, so women are less likely to seek help, so therefore there's a proportion of women we don't know about. But also what we do know from kind of the broader social research is that in Western countries where values are very much focused on kind of the positivity of youth and the negative kind of consequences of aging, we know that overall in terms of menopause, women have a more negative experience because, you know, often we think of kind of aging is, and menopause is linked to this view of decline. A lot of the kind of media coverage at the moment, certainly a lot of things that I see online talk about this idea of estrogen deficiency. So it's almost a disease model. We know that in other countries, so I think in Japan, for example, they see it as a period of change and transition. So I'm not talking directly about hot flushes, but I think the menopause as an experience we know varies from country to country, and certainly we can kind of link in the cultural climate of that country will have an influence on women's experiences. Similarly, there was a really interesting study back in 2021 that looked at, kind of within country differences. So they found that menopause starts earlier, hot flushes and night sweat symptoms are more common and longer lasting in African American women as opposed to white American women.
Okay.
So again, the picture is complex and suggested reasons by those authors for the disparities was about kind of life stressors, potentially structural racism and inequality. So I guess there is no easy answer, but there's lots of ideas about things that might influence experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Like most things, there's no simple answer, and it's probably a whole range of different factors that contribute to different symptoms that people experience. So.
Absolutely.
So just a question with regards to hot flushes. Are hot flushes the same as blushing?
The same as blushing? No. Blushing is a physiological response that has a kind of component of social anxiety. So we often blush when we feel embarrassed or ashamed. So obviously the reddening of our skin, but when anybody feels embarrassed, if they do blush, it's very much driven by a stress response. So there are kind of some crossover with hot flushes, but what we know fundamentally about hot flushes is that it's very much driven by a thermoregulatory response. So women going through menopause, estrogen affects a lot of different systems within the body, and something that we all have called the thermoneutral zone. So that's kind of the range of temperatures our body can experience before our temperature regulation processes kick in. Women going through menopause, estrogen has an impact on the thermoneutral zone, that it narrows, so smaller fluctuations in temperature, either internal body temperature or environmental temperature, then can activate temperature regulation mechanisms. So hot flushes effectively, or our body's attempt to kind of cool ourselves down. With hot flushes, these are physiologically driven sensations of heat. So we experience a sudden increase in heat, sweating and flushing. And basically, during menopause, the changes in estrogen have an impact on our body's thermoregulatory system. So all of us will have something that we call a thermoneutral zone. So if our body temperature kind of stays within that zone, then we're pretty much unaware of it. Our body doesn't kick in to kind of temperature regulation processes. So when we get too hot, for example, that's when our body kind of, we start to sweat, and we can often get flushed in the face, and that's kind of our body's attempt to cool us down, bring our body temperature back into the thermoneutral zone. Similarly, minor dips in temperature, that's often what kind of leads to some women experience chills and shivering as well. So it all comes down to this kind of narrowed thermoneutral zone, the kind of hot flush and night sweat symptoms.
Wow. All right, and so it's the changes in the estrogen levels that narrow that thermoneutral zone.
Yeah, there was an old study, relatively old study, that kind of hypothesized this as process, and so that's the understanding that we kind of have taken moving forward, just showing kind of the complexity of estrogen and how it impacts our kind of body. There's still a lot that we don't know about it, and in terms of blushing or social anxiety or anxiety generally, actually a lot of women also experience, when they have a hot flush, palpitations, or they might feel dizzy or feel kind of a bit ill or nauseous. And in terms of the kind of overlap with blushing, a lot of women can find hot flushes embarrassing. So you might have initially kind of the thermoregulatory response of the hot flush, but then women might feel anxious about that, or typically it happens at the times when you don't want it to, in the middle of a meeting, or so that's when it kind of, there's that overlap with embarrassment, and that's the that interaction between the physiological and the psychological, which is the sort of things that we would focus on in a cognitive behavioural context.
So I know certainly you've done some fascinating work on CBT for menopause and hot flushes and vasomotor symptoms. So, and CBT is not the treatment that first comes to mind when you think about treating menopausal symptoms. So you can you first tell us a bit about CBT and how it kind of works in the area of menopause?
Yeah, so as we know, CBT is evidence-based, initially established for kind of anxiety and depression. And then over the years, it's developed and the evidence has accumulated so that cognitive behaviour therapy can be applied to a range of both psychological and physical health issues. So it is a talking therapy, and I think often there's a bit of a misunderstanding about, well, I've got my menopause symptoms, so how would talking help? So I think it's kind of helpful to understand that actually, as we know, CBT is about looking at coping behaviours, the influence of our thoughts and our mindset, and how that impacts our experience of kind of day-to-day situations and how we feel, what we do in those situations. So it can be applied to menopause symptoms precisely because we know that they can be stressful, they can be really distressing for many women, and it was initially kind of started because we know that women, for example, who have been treated for breast cancer, HRT, which would be your kind of typical go-to choice for particularly kind of hot flushes and night sweats, some of the other symptoms as well, there are contraindications for HRT. So you have a population of women that can't access the treatment of choice. So initially it was developed for that, but then myself and Professor Myra Hunter that kind of led the research, we also kind of looked at developing it for women who, for whatever reason, have decided they don't want HRT or they'd rather look at kind of a different approach. So really, I think overall, CBT looks at helping women to understand the physiological symptoms of menopause, give them education about what's going on. So, for example, the thermoneutral zone and hot flushes, that's part of the intervention, is understanding what is going on there, normalizing symptoms. When I was kind of involved in the research groups, I saw that without doing any specific cognitive or psychological work with women about managing hot flushes, actually just understanding what was going on from a thermoneutral zone perspective reduced anxiety. For a lot of women, it kind of, that's what my body's doing. So it's not kind of, once they had that understanding, that takes away some of the anxiety that can come along with menopause symptoms.
So does CBT work by reducing the emotional response associated with the different symptoms that women experience, or does it actually reduce the frequency and severity of hot flushes?
So I think there are different components to the CBT intervention. So there's kind of, we focus specifically on hot flushes and night sweats. So part of it is understanding kind of what is going on, in terms of the thermoneutral zone, but then bringing in, getting women to think about and recognise their emotional responses and the role that thoughts play in that and how they were coping at the moment. So later on in the intervention, we certainly looked at. So how do you remain calm? How do you support yourself during, you know, a hot flush in the middle of a meeting, or if you're feeling embarrassed about it, or for, you know, a lot of women felt really anxious, felt their body was out of control. So kind of giving them calming strategies. A really important component of the intervention that I kind of observed as kind of delivering the intervention, and also that we found in terms of outcomes, was stress management comes before any kind of direct work on hot flushes or night sweats. And the impact of taking steps to reduce stress was really significant. So obviously this is anecdotally, but within the groups, the women that were able to kind of make changes early on started to report kind of, oh, my symptoms feel less frequent, or, you know, I feel like they've improved this week, even before we'd even kind of started doing any work directly on how do you manage a hot flush in this situation. Or so, yeah, I can't emphasize enough how big stress management is in terms of just a general approach.
Okay, so you start off with the education. So you obviously provide some information, education about some of the symptoms and some of the physiological changes that occur. And then you talk about, and then part CBT also incorporates some stress management techniques. Is general stress management techniques, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. General stress management techniques. So the cohort of women, if we think of kind of women going through menopause today and the kind of life stresses that they're experiencing, so often they're working in quite high pressure jobs, plus they might have young or older children, so they're still in the role of kind of hands-on parenting. They might have elderly relatives who are in need of kind of care. So certainly the women in our groups were kind of, they were juggling an awful lot of things. And it's not specifically for menopausal women, but actually it's kind of looking, you know, the idea of having time to themselves and focusing on actually what do you need at the moment. That was almost, for a lot of women, quite alien. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, well, I haven't even got time to think of myself because I'm making sure that this is okay and this. So encouraging women to focus on what's going on for me at the moment. If they managed to do that, that just made such a big difference.
Okay, so it's just obviously the self-care, the awareness of different triggers, the awareness of different stresses. I suppose that the thing is, during that age of the menopausal transition, there's often a lot of changes that are going on in people's lives, and obviously there's changes in parenting responsibilities, work responsibilities. I even read a study that also shows that divorce rates are kind of peak around about that time too. So there's a whole range of different stresses that can particularly exacerbate just normal stress and anxiety and mood-related problems.
Yeah, absolutely. So we know actually for both women and men during midlife, there's a kind of reduction in emotional well-being. For women in particular, it's a time of physiological change. So, you know, during perimenopause and menopause, there's hormone fluctuation. So that's obviously going to have an impact in terms of how they're physically feeling. But then there's all the kind of various commitments and responsibilities and a big kind of psychological change as well. It's almost, it's a biopsychosocial transition, I think, and kind of reevaluating. And I think that's what the kind of part of the stress work tapped into, was just perhaps getting women to look at everything that they were applying themselves to 100%, mm-hmm. And then kind of recognise, actually, you know, that I'm struggling with these symptoms, or they're having an impact on my quality of life and my sleep. So therefore, one of the first steps is to look at, how do I make life a bit easier for myself at the moment? You know, are there any, even if it was just carving out a little bit of time for well-being, we're not even talking about huge amounts of time, because a lot of women found it really difficult to fit in, but just helping them to recognise that even 10 minutes here or 10 minutes there would kind of just make a difference, particularly when understanding that the thermoneutral zone can also be impacted by stress, that can kind of further narrow the thermoneutral zone. So that then gives them a bit of a kind of rationale, if you like, to help them to engage in stress work.
And would it incorporate even things like, you know, breathing practice, meditation, mindfulness techniques, those types of things too?
Yeah, absolutely. So we taught the women paced breathing, which is actually diaphragmatic breathing, but it's called paced breathing for some reason in the menopause literature. Mm-hmm. So again, we know that paced breathing just is calms the nervous system. So it's really helpful when people are kind of chronically stressed. So that was something that we would practice at every session, and we'd encourage them to practice it outside of sessions as well, both in terms of stress, but also then moving forward into the hot flush work, practicing pace breathing at the onset of a flush. So you're changing their attention focus to kind of the symptoms of the flush developing, and even like then the psychological consequences for some women in terms of people are noticing, what will they think, or what is my body doing? So you're kind of just redirecting their attention to kind of calm breathing, which was found to be helpful. We didn't look specifically at mindfulness and other practices in our research, but I know that there have been other studies that have found, you know, mindfulness-based stress reduction has also kind of been helpful for women going through the menopause transition.
So I'm just thinking about, so obviously a lot of our listeners are practitioners, so obviously there's that, I'm just thinking about the kind of different steps. So there's the education component, the thermoneutral zone, education about that, some of the factors that can influence that thermoneutral zone, then just some stress management in general, and we're not even talking about menopause in general, we're just talking about normal stress management techniques. Would you also incorporate things like, you know, exercise and the foods that they eat and things like that too?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, it was very kind of individual to the women that we were working with, but we know that exercise, moderate exercise, can be really helpful for hot flushes. Intense exercise may actually trigger them, but obviously that's about the temperature regulation mechanisms. So as part of the initial education about kind of hot flushes and just kind of recognizing the broader factors, which again is helpful because it gives women an element of control. So anything that kind of has an impact on body temperature, it is a kind of trigger. We know that lifestyle triggers can be responsible for up to 50% of hot flushes. So we got women to look at caffeine intake. So for some women, they'd say it was the caffeine in kind of tea or coffee that made them more likely to have a hot flush. And for others, it might have been the actual temperature of the drink. A lot of women said alcohol was a trigger, and spicy foods, and just changes in environmental temperature even were triggers. So we would get them to think about, you know, can you wear layers so that it's quite easy to reduce your body temperature and cool down if you go into a warm environment. But certainly exercise we were encouraging, just in terms of the general positive impact that it has on well-being. So,
Okay. Now, obviously with CBT, the cognitive bit, the thoughts, the belief systems that people have, we know that in terms of depression and anxiety, how we think can affect how we feel. Are there particular thoughts or beliefs that women may have that may exacerbate that? Is it target of CBT for menopause?
Yeah, so more broadly, I think in CBT, we're encouraging women to view it as a normal transition, yeah? So that doesn't mean that it's pleasant and problem-free. Obviously, symptoms can be really distressing, but I guess what we're encouraging them to do is to move away from this idea of decline and to view it more as a normal, if not challenging at times, part of the kind of female reproductive lifestyle. And we also, you know, we get them to think about what are the kind of common words that are usually attached to menopause and menopausal women in today's society. And 99% of them are just really negative and horrible stereotypes. So we do that kind of early on in the intervention because we want them to be aware, really, of the kind of social and cultural impact and how that's going to impact their experience and encourage them, I guess, to begin to just question it and feel a bit more empowered about that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I suppose even having thoughts like that people are looking at me, I'm unattractive, those types of thoughts are going to affect people's responses and feelings and emotions and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So being aware of that kind of general cultural climate then helps us to understand the kind of some of their negative responses to symptoms such as hot flushes or kind of a lot of menopause symptoms. So really common kind of thinking responses or cognitive responses are about the social, the shame aspect of it. So everyone can see I'm menopausal or I feel really embarrassed, everyone's looking at me or they'll all think I'm old. And then there's the kind of more kind of panic, anxiety driven, what, you know, my body's out of control, I can't cope with this. And we also know that women worry about the impact that night sweats have on daytime functioning. So I'm not going to be able to function the next day at work, you know, if I've been up a lot of the night with kind of night sweats. So what we do within the intervention is we help them to familiarise themselves really with a kind of vicious cycle approach. So how do you respond when you're particularly distressed or stressed about a hot flush or a symptom? Let's capture what those thoughts are and let's look at how you currently cope. And then further into the intervention, we're not obviously, this is a common myth I think about CBT, we're not encouraging them to think happy thoughts and everything's fine. We're helping them to develop kind of self-compassion and self-supportive thoughts to just kind of calmly manage the situation. So, but obviously they familiarise themselves with this idea of the cognitive aspect. So thoughts aren't facts, their review of the situation. And actually when my symptoms are really stressful, my brain is automatically going to go through to a more kind of anxious response, which then can set them up into a vicious cycle. So we know that self-compassion has a positive impact on women's experience of hot flushes. There was a study in 2021 that showed that self-compassion had a stronger relationship to hot flushes and night sweats and anxiety than the frequency of hot flushes. And another study in 2015, self-compassion and feeling in control was linked with kind of psychological well-being over and above the physical symptoms of menopause. So we're kind of, that's where the cognitive part of the intervention is kind of hoping to direct women to.
Yeah, okay. All right. So I suppose it's You know, what is it that you're saying to yourself when you're experiencing a hot flush? Can we challenge some of those beliefs and some of those thoughts? Or alternatively, are there more helpful things that we could say to help us manage things? So it's, because I know sometimes obviously the symptoms aren't pleasant. So trying to, like you said, you know, turn them into a positive thought is probably going to result in some resistance. But rather than saying it's pleasant or unpleasant, it's what can I say that's more helpful? And you mentioned, obviously, many women may go back to the paced breathing. That might be a way to kind of stop some of the thoughts is by just focusing on their breath.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, absolutely not positive thinking, because that's really how to, like, help people disengage from the therapy.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's kind of, I think what we're encouraging them to do is recognise when they go immediately into a kind of panic or socially anxious or just general stress response in response to symptoms. And part of cognitive therapy is kind of being empathic with yourself and going, right, this is tough, actually. This situation is really quite challenging, but let me see kind of how I can talk myself through. So we kind of look in sessions at alternative responses. We encourage women to think about, if a friend was in this situation, how would you respond? And, you know, that helps them then to identify, actually, with a friend, I'd be really empathic and I'd give her some self-support. So I wouldn't say, it's fine, carry on, or something equally unhelpful. You know, they were able then to tune into empathy and kind of calm talking themselves through the situation and maybe evaluating it in a kind of more objective way that took away some of the anxiety.
And I suppose what we haven't talked about, which is also maybe a important component, is also some of the strategies of how they manage their sleep hygiene, those types of things would also be important for many women too.
Yeah, so we talked, didn't we, about sleep disruption earlier. So again, the intervention very much focuses on firstly improving sleep quality. So we look at sleep hygiene, but actually we look at some of the more CBTI approaches to get them, to help them to understand the complexity of sleep. So sleep education is part of that. And again, that's kind of normalizing, kind of, it's quite normal for people to wake up. We recognize that obviously with menopause your sleep may be more disrupted, or you might have night sweats that disrupt sleep, but helping women to understand that sleep is complex, it's about cycles and it's about kind of the quality of sleep. And we know that helping them to understand that kind of deep sleep tends to occur at the beginning of the night, that even after waking, if they're able to get back to sleep, then they're likely then to go into a further cycle of sleep. I have read something recently to say that on kind of objective sleep measures, that there's an increase in slow wave sleep for women when they are asleep, even if their sleep is disrupted. So there's kind of this idea that, you know, the brain is kind of compensating, if you like, for the sleep disruption. But what we're really looking at with the CBTI insomnia work, again, is recognizing that menopause can disrupt sleep, but often it's our response to that, you know, the kind of normal worry and frustration that can then exacerbate the issue. So again, getting them to apply some of their CBT skills to managing difficulties getting to sleep, how they respond when they wake up. So, you know, getting them from kind of panicking and becoming really stressed and awake to just kind of cooling off if they need to, if it's kind of a night sweat that's woken them up, and then encouraging them to practice, get back into the breathing and relaxation. So again, we're looking at responses to symptoms as a key factor. And then we also look at responding to kind of night sweats, which again is kind of similar to hot flushes. It's about temperature regulation, setting up the bedroom environment to promote kind of a cooler environment, particularly if they're suffering from night sweats. And just looking at little things that they can do that can help promote sleep quality in the menopause, but also what they can do it when if they are waking up.
Terrific. Wow. So, I mean, obviously we could, we're touching on CBT for menopause and that we really can't go through it in depth on any of these, but there's certainly really some important components that you mentioned. Obviously, you know, the beliefs and the self-talk that people have, the stress management that's important, some of the sleep behaviours that they engage in and some of the thoughts and responses they have to disruptions in sleep. They're all the really important components for CBT for menopause. So if a health practitioner wants to learn more about CBT for menopause, what do you recommend? Where can they go?
At the moment I do a training webinar with the British Menopause Society twice a year.
Okay.
So we have actually had people sign up from Australia and attend that. So that's one of the options. There's also kind of the books that myself and Professor Myra Hunter have co-authored that might be worth looking at.
Yep, and I'll certainly give them a plug. So Living Well Through Menopause, and another one was Managing Hot Flushes and Night Sweats. So I certainly recommend that if people want to learn more about this, then they certainly read those books. They have lots of great information.
Yeah, so the Managing Hot Flushes and Night Sweats is on one of the kind of trials that we did. It was the Well Women trial. So with the women who'd completed treatment for breast cancer, they had the group intervention. But with the Well Women, we looked at comparing group intervention and also self-help. And they had the same outcomes in terms of improved mood and quality of life and reduced intrusiveness of symptoms. And so the actual self-help book that we used on that trial is in the Managing Hot Flushes and Night Sweats book. So it's kind of a weekly, you work it through week by week. It's divided up into sessions and it's got kind of materials in there. Living Well Through Menopause is kind of it's the sort of book that you can probably dip in and out of a little bit more. So it's got kind of management strategies for kind of hot flushes, night sweats, but generally well-being. And it also looks at things such as pain and fatigue and kind of coping strategies for that. If you, either women can't take HRT or they don't want to. So that's the kind of difference between the two books.
Terrific. Now we'll certainly have links in the show notes to those resources if people want to learn more about that. So it'd be great. Thank you very much, Melanie, for discussing some of your work that you've done, some of the fascinating work that you've done. And I think a really important component to managing menopause is that psychological and lifestyle-based approaches, which often neglected. And I know that often HRT is the first treatment of choice that women refer to, but obviously there's lots that we can do as health practitioners.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, kind of CBT is also kind of applicable to women who are taking HRT. So,
yes.
I think there's kind of, in terms of general lifestyle improvements and general coping and stress management, I do think it's kind of part of that broader holistic approach and hopefully, can be used by anyone who's interested, really.
Yeah, and you've shown through nice clinical trials that they're effective. So we've got evidence-based treatment that that practitioners know is going to be helpful for many of their clients.
Yeah, absolutely. It's in the it's part of the NICE guidelines that have just been revised in the UK, and they're kind of the evidence-based informed clinical practice in the UK guidelines. So it's good to see that CBT was a component of that and suggested as, kind of a way forward for women if they were interested in it. But I think, the key important message for me really is that it's about the individual women, that they have, kind of choice and you know, nothing's imposed on them. It's about them being able to kind of have those discussions, isn't it, with healthcare professionals, and for CBT to be available for them if that's what they're interested in.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. So I greatly appreciate you giving us the time to be able to talk about some of the fascinating work and that you've done, and sounds like ongoing work that you're doing in the area.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. It's been really nice to talk to you.
No problem. So thank you, everyone, for listening today. Don't forget that you can find all the show notes, transcripts and other resources from today's episode on the FX Medicine by Bioceuticals website. I'm Dr. Adrian Lapresti, and thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
This podcast is intended as healthcare practitioner education only, and it is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to FX Medicine, and share us with your family, friends, and colleagues.